there are some odd characters inhabiting Mutasia. One animal, for example, is part cow, part possum. Another is a combination of a mosquito and a wasp. The creatures are included in stories that help young readers better understand their world. The second book in the Mutasia series is Clubhouse Clash and is written by Justin Minkle. Justin, an elementary school teacher in the Springdale School District, was named Arkansas's Teacher of the Year in 2007. He says his book about a misunderstanding that escalates into a full conflict was inspired, in part, by watching his students. He recently stopped by the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums.
So the world and the characters were created by other people other than me, some really brilliant artists that kind of brought everything to life visually. And what I love about it is that it's basically this island where there are no adults. It's sort of this society of children. And in a way, it sort of flips Lord of the Flies because, you know, there's no adults, but instead of terrible things happening, they all get along just fine, you know. But the characters, even though they're children, the actual characters are animals, and they're sort of hybrid animals. So, you know, like they've got these stuffed animals I brought in with me today, and the main character is fused with a cow and a possum, and there's another character that's like a cheetah and an elephant, and, you know, sort of the heroine of this story is a gazelle mixed with a bird, like with a duck. So, and I think that's why kids are so into it and why, you know, like my son Aiden, who's two, loves the stuffed animals so much, is there's sort of been a saturation of characters who are animals, like Winnie the Pooh, Kung Fu Panda. But at the same time, this is kind of different from something like Dr. Seuss, where who knows what those things are, because kids recognize the pieces of a possum or the trunk of an elephant or whatever. You know, Aiden said, oh, I love his trunk. Look at his trunk. But they're strange. You know, they're hybrid animals. So.
And they live in this island. It's, as the story goes, it has not been found by humans. But there are different places. So, I mean, you can see touches of J.R. Tolkien in this, mm-hmm. because here's where the swamplands are and here's who lives there. And so there's a map available.
Yeah, definitely. And what I love about the setting of this particular book is it was in a part of the island called Tree Village. And as soon as I read about it, I was like, okay, I'm in. You know, and like you said about Tolkien, it reminded me of Lorien, you know, sort of these enormous trees. You know, I lived in the Bay Area for a while, so it reminded me of the Redwoods. Mm-hmm. And I just love it because there's not a lot of urban influence. You know, there's not a lot of technology. The kids, the animals are really resourceful. You know, they sort of make their own things. And it's basically the middle of a forest.
So how did you connect with the people who created this land to write a story for them?
I really feel like I lucked out. It was a teacher of the year who's the 2007 Illinois Teacher of the Year, and his vision for this was that he'd find writers who were also teachers of the year.
And which that, you were for Arkansas.
Yeah, for Arkansas. And so the idea is that then, you know, the books are good adventure stories on their own. They stand alone, but he'd also have these teachers go through and create lesson plans that go with them. So if a teacher wanted to do it as a read aloud with a little guided reading group in class, there's all these lessons that kind of build on the themes or the adventure in the book. So, you know, this the previous book was written by the Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. It's like kind of one out of these 10 books that will be coming out. The third book will be, you know, this Illinois Teacher of the Year, and then I did the second one.
Now, I don't want to give too much away, but what happens in this book is a mean song is written by one animal about another, and it escalates, right? It's called Clubhouse Clash, so things start happening.
Exactly, yeah. And I feel like there were influences from books I read as a kid. Like, I always loved the Butter Battle book, you know, which is about the Cold War, but it's basically this escalation of increasingly giant weapons. And so a similar thing happens here where, you know, you're exactly right. There's a song that is sort of misheard, sort of like if you ever played that game Telephone, mm-hmm. where you start with a normal sentence and it ends up getting so garbled. So a friend overhears that song and thinks it's mean and relays it to this kid in the book who gets really kind of upset and decides that she's after him, and it leads to this escalating clash of the clubhouses. The idea actually came from my third grader's conflicts at recess. I mean, that's what it came out of. And so what I noticed is there was a real gender divide for second and third graders. So with the boys, it was usually very straightforward. You know, Carlos kicked me when we were playing soccer. I got mad, so I punched him in the head. But now we're fine. You know, it's very physical, very violent, and it's over right away.
Right.
For the girls, it was this really elaborate kind of set of miscommunications. So I'd have a student come up a lot of times just in tears and say, Daniela doesn't want to be my friend anymore. And my question was always, you know, did you hear her say that? Well, no, but Maria's cousin heard that when she was at her house last week, then Anna told her that her friend overheard, you know, and so it's
right.
This chain of miscommunication. And a lot of times once she goes up to that girl, it's not what the girl said at all.
I don't mean to get away from the book for a minute, but is that something that happens when you're a teacher? Like you, because those of us who don't have children or aren't in the schools, we think you're teaching reading or math or whatever. But do you hear their problems a lot? Their personal?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think a lot of it, too, is, you know, what you realize pretty quickly is that if you can address those things, what are really going on with the kids, it actually saves you so much time to really teach the academic stuff. So, you know, my wife Karen and I were teaching in New York, and we realized that even though we had all these systems in place, the kids had conflicts that really distracted them, and recess and lunch would just ruin a child. You know, they'd come back angry, and it was just over for the day. So we developed this idea that's actually in the book of a peace talk that's really straightforward, where the kids go off on their own. There's no adults involved, but we teach the process up front. They basically say, you know, when you did this, I felt this way. I felt angry. You know, when you talked about how my drawing looked silly and you laughed, it made me feel embarrassed. You know, next time I want you to just tell me that quietly, not in front of the class. So there's just, you know, here's how I felt. Here's what I want you to change. The other child says it, and then they shake hands if they want, and it's done. And it was amazingly effective, even though it was so simple. And so that's kind of the resolution in here, is that idea of a peace talk.
When you're writing a book like this, I mean, this is aimed for young readers. Do you hope that that sinks in? I mean, as a writer, you never know what is taken away. But is that kind of the hope, that maybe there will be some of that done in real life?
Definitely. And I think that's kind of the vision for these books, is that they don't want them to be preachy. They don't want there to be a lesson. They're not fables, you know, where there's this really heavy-handed moral at the end. But at the same time, the idea is, you know, they're written not just for parents who want to share them with their kids, but teachers who might want to use them in the class. And so for this one, some of the lesson plans that come out of it deal with those themes of conflict, not just between two kids, but between nations. And a lot of the language is the same. A lot of the principles are the same. So if you look in this book, you know, there's the idea of innocent bystanders, for example. When we get into this clash of the clubhouses, most of the people who get hurt are not the ones actually involved in the conflict. They're all the neighbors who end up getting smashed by mistake, sort of collateral damage, you know. And then just the idea of escalation, that it can start with a miscommunication. Pretty soon it leads to kind of a physical conflict, and it gets out of hand really quickly. So, yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot of implications for kids, but also when they look at history and kind of the history of war with people.
How does it work that you're writing scenes and dialogue and attitudes of characters that somebody else has invented? Was there back and forth like, wait a second, this character wouldn't do that or might do it in a different way?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time looking through just the images that had been created by the artists, and then there's sort of these profiles, you know, of what the characters are like. So one of my favorites is sort of the heroine, Zabetta, and she's a little bit like Katniss Everdeen in the Hunger Games books. You know, she's very resourceful. She's very fierce. She's a loyal friend, but you really don't want to mess with her. You know, she kind of creates her own weapons, you know, her own tools. And so I read a lot of that sort of background, and then it helped me, too, that there'd already been one book written in the series, so I could sort of look at, you know, not only kind of their personality, but everything down to the way they talk and sort of, you know, their demeanor. So in some ways, I think it helped me to have that context. It wasn't sitting down from scratch the way it is with these other novels I'm trying to get published, where I created everything and it took years. There was already a map. There were already characters there.
All right, Justin Minkle, author of Clubhouse Clash. Do you mind reading a bit from this?
Sure.
And what's happening here?
So I'll pick up in the middle, where basically the conflict has gotten out of hand. There's two warring clubhouses. One is these two female characters, Zabetta, who I just mentioned, and sort of her sidekick. The other is Figley, who's this really sweet, kind of emotional male character, and he's got his own sidekick. And so they're kind of escalating the conflict when we come here at the top of these giant trees in Tree Village. Smash. Oh, and one thing I should tell you. These creatures who are hybrids, some of them already existed, but we could also create our own. So one of the creatures I invented in here is called a waspido. So it's basically a combination of a wasp and a mosquito. So something you would not want to mess with. They have the proboscis to sting you on the front. They've also got the stinger on the end. So one of the weapons that the kids end up using in here are these waspido hives. So it's sort of like a hornet's nest, but worse.
Before you go, what dark place in your brain came up with a cross between a wasp and a mosquito?
You know, I have no idea. I was just reading so many of these hybrid creatures in here. I just thought it would be a terrible thing. I love the name. It sort of sounds like torpedo, you know.
And it sounds like something you'd find in the Ozarks.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, every year I see bugs I've never seen before, despite living here since third grade. So here it is. Smash. A waspido hive struck a house just below Figley's hut. Figley's neighbor, a little kid with floppy ears and a beak, ran out onto his porch. He howled in pain as he flapped his big ears at the cloud of waspidos hovering above him. Figley and Waddy ran to load the first arrow into their crossbow. Fire! Waddy yelled. They pulled the trigger, and the huge arrow flew into the air. The arrow missed Zabetta's hut, but it smashed into the next tree over. The gourd at the arrow's tip shattered against a tree, slopping swamp slime into the hammock that belonged to Zabetta's neighbor, an amphibious marsupial. The marsupial hopped out of her hammock and scooped the slime out of her pouch, shaking her fist at the sky. A kind of madness took hold of Figley and Waddy then. They loaded each arrow as fast as they could, breathing hard. Fig Leaf's heart pounded in his chest, and the blood beat in his ears like thunder. Crashes, smashes, howls, yowls, whacks, and thwacks cracked the peaceful night. There were some near misses. Fig Leaf leapt off the porch just before a rotten stenchelope would have thumped him on the head, and Rumbler ducked an arrow that almost crushed her fuzzy belly. But most of the arrows and ammo missed their targets, creating havoc in Tree Village. Neighbors had fled their homes for the ground below, abandoning their huts as huge arrows flew through their windows and stenchelopes splattered their doors. Waddy and Figley loaded their last arrow into the crossbow and then stopped. An eerie silence had fallen. "They must be out of ammo for their catapult," Waddy squealed. He rubbed his hands together, grinning a crazy grin. "We won the war." Figley looked around at the broken branches and smashed huts. He listened to the wails and sobs from the frightened neighbors gathered below. Just an hour ago, this had been their peaceful neighborhood. "If this is what it feels like to win," he said softly, "I'd hate to lose."
Okay, so we hear that. Should we, you know, it's easy to extrapolate that there's something bigger you're talking about here.
Yeah, and again, I mean, that's what I think when you look at conflict resolution with kids, you know, not only does it sort of help them resolve their conflicts, but it helps them think through human conflict, you know, not only the problem, but also the solution, you know, that you get to later. And I think, again, you know, that idea of innocent bystanders, I mean, if you look at something, you know, contemporary like Syria, a lot of times the people that get hurt the most are not the ones who are actually firing the weapons. It's all those innocent people who really just want to go about their lives, you know, the innocent bystanders.
We defined a waspito, a stenchelope?
Stenchelope is basically like a cantaloupe, except with a horrible, swampy smell.
Is it fun to come up with stuff like this?
It's great. Yeah, it's great. And that's what I think kids will like so much about the world. It's just, it's so colorful. It's so vivid. It reminds me of a rainforest in terms of just the diversity of plant life and animal life. There's something here called snapping myrtle that's sort of like a crepe myrtle combined with a snapping turtle, where it's a plant sort of like a Venus flytrap, but this beak pops out, you know? So it's just this kind of crazy world. And there's a lot of, you know, great art that's been done by the artists involved. You know, there's all these stuffed animals. They actually have a couple little animated shorts they're coming out with now. So it's just a fun, colorful world.
What do you think is the effect of making it an adult-free world? I mean, we're talking not humans, but animals. But having them being somewhat juvenile, do you think young readers get something from that?
Yeah, I think in some ways it's every kid's fantasy to have a world without adults. I mean, you know, the reality might be harder than they think. But, you know, this other book that I wrote that I'm working on getting published now, the premise is in some ways similar to Harry Potter, that there's this school where you learn these, you know, magical abilities. But the difference is it's a school run by children. And when I ask my students, you know, what would you think about a school run by kids? No adults, no teacher, no principal. You know, their eyes light up and they get really excited. I also talked, you know, I went down to one of the Arkansas Society of Children Book Writers and Illustrators conferences, and they had an agent there, and she said the biggest problem she sees with manuscripts that come to her are that adults solve the problems. And she said, you know, it's fine to have adults in there, like Dumbledore is in Harry Potter, but ultimately it's Harry and Ron and Hermione that are solving the problems.
I had never thought about that, but some of the books that I enjoyed so much as a young reader, the Hardy Boys and things like that, it was the younger people who were eventually solving. They might have aid from adults.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Boxcar Children for the same reason. It's these kids kind of seeing, can they make it on their own, you know, without all the rules of adults.
You're a writer. You're also someone who you preach the value of reading at a very young age. You've seen how reading makes students better, right?
Definitely. Yeah, one of the projects I worked on lately was this home library project called the 1,000 Books Project, where basically I realized my students who are at Jones Elementary in Springdale, mostly lower income, mostly English learners, a lot of them had 3 books at home or 7 books. Then I looked at my daughter, who then was 2, who had, you know, these 3 shelves filled, and I just realized it's such an obvious thing, but having those books in your life, like you just talked about with the Hardy Boys, it has a tremendous influence. You know, so we did this project where the kids built up a home library of 40 books, and I just saw a tremendous change, not just as readers in terms of ability, but as people, as human beings.
Someone, I don't know if it was you, termed coined the term book gap, that there are kids who have a lot of books in their lives and some children who don't.
Yeah, and the research I read was pretty staggering. I mean, they talked about, you know, even in middle-class families, it was a lot lower than I would have thought, about 12 books to a kid, and they talked about some inner-city neighborhoods being crazy. I mean, it was like 300 children for one age-appropriate book. And so I think it's something that schools just don't think about. Yeah, and so that's kind of the, like, when I'm writing it, I just enjoy it. I get into the story. I feel like sometimes the characters do things I didn't intend at some point. You know, you write it and you're like, wow, I didn't see that coming until I was in the middle of writing. But at the same time, when you're done, I mean, that's part of the hope is that these kids will experience these books. You know, I grew up in Stone County, Arkansas, where there was a library. It wasn't incredible, but my dad would always mail me these books when he had to leave for the work, you know, in other states. And so I'd run down, you know, this gravel road and open it, and there'd be, you know, the Great Brain book or, you know, Children of the Dragon, some fantasy book. And it's just incredibly exciting.
So where can people find this book?
Nightbird Books. Lisa Sharp, who's wonderful and always supports local authors, has, you know, agreed to order some books, and she'll keep it in stock there. You know, by the time this airs, I will have just done a little signing with some other local authors, and she has those sort of local author extravaganzas every once in a while. And there's also a website, mutasia.com. It's just mutasia.com.
So that's how it's pronounced. I had a reader's vocabulary in that, Mutasia.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, for the mutation.
Exactly.
I gotcha. Yeah. Well, who are your friends that you brought with you?
So I've got three of the characters here. They have these little stuffed animals. Zabetta, you know, who's my probably my favorite.
And you made her the heroine of your book.
Exactly, yeah. And she is, you know, part gazelle, part duck, like her duck legs here. Then Figley is sort of the hero of a lot of the books, or sort of the protagonist. He's, you know, part possum and part cow. And then Chadwick is, you know, fairly scientific. He's got this long sort of elephant trunk, but he's more of sort of a cheetah.
I like it. And the other book you mentioned that you're working on, or have you completed it?
Yeah, I've completed it, and right now I'm sending it out to agents and publishers. It's, you know, for kids in the middle grades. It's a little bit older than these. This book is really, you know, for kids to read on their own, maybe first, second, third graders, up to fifth graders who get excited about, you know, the Clash of the Clubhouses. And then as a read aloud for kids as young as my daughter, who's five.
Do you remember a couple of books that when you were very young, some of the first books you read that really got you hooked on reading?
Definitely. I mean, my mom read me The Hobbit when I was really little, and it was too hard for me. And something about that idea of Bilbo Baggins just loving home so much, but also, you know, loving the adventures he had really stuck. I've read that one probably 20 times. Like when I went to West Africa,
wow.
I read it on the plane. About any time I take this big trip, you know. And then just, you know, I was always into fantasy books as a kid.
All right. Justin, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Kyle.
Justin Minkle is the author of the new book, Clubhouse Clash, that is part of the Mutasia series for young readers. He is an elementary school teacher in Springdale and was named the Arkansas Teacher of the Year in 2007. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this month.